Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome back to The Midpoint with me, Gabby Logan. My guest today is not only a fellow sports broadcaster, she's also a good friend. Jill Douglas has been part of some of the biggest sporting events on telly for the last three decades. Whether it was for BBC Scotland in the early days of her career or later for Sky Sports, BT Sport and ITV, Jill's love of sport and depth of knowledge have made her a popular broadcaster with both viewers and her colleagues. And whether it's rugby, cycling, snooker or the Olympics, Jill has mastered the art of the live trackside interview, notoriously tricky and hard to predict. Jill was also great friends with late Scottish rugby legend Doddy Weir. And from 2018 to very recently, in 2024, Jill was CEO of the motor neurone disease charity My Name's Doddy Foundation. So our expert today is Professor of Neurology and Complex Disease Genetics at King's College London, Amar Al-Shalabi. Amar has been researching MND for the last 30 years and is hopefully going to shed some light for us on any advancements that are being made. Right now, though, it's Jill. Jill Douglas, finally on The Midpoint. How are you?
I'm really well. Very good to see you. Delighted to be here.
Well, I have to say, you are really well. You look fantastic. I haven't seen you in the flesh for ages. What's going on?
How bad did I look before, Gabby?
No, you looked great before, but your skin's glowing. Yeah. You look like you've embarked on some kind of new fitness regime.
You're very kind. I've had a couple of cheeky ski trips, actually, which probably is why I'm looking glowing. But also, yeah, about a year ago, I was looking forward to the Rugby World Cup and I looked at myself on the green screen studio shot and thought, I need to do something. This is unsustainable. I've never carried a lot of weight, but I was definitely heavier than I felt comfortable.
Do you think that was a midlife change?
Yeah, I think so. Definitely. I think going through perimenopause, you put on weight and it's much more difficult to lose the weight when you get to an age. And so, yeah. And so I kind of stopped drinking a lot of wine, tried to cut back on food, and took more exercise. I was telling you, my son said to me, Mom, the quickest program is just eat less, drink less and take more exercise, which seems very simple.
And he would have been 16 at the time when he came up with that wisdom. Is he going to market this? Is he going to put it in a book?
Yeah, he'll probably be on this very show one day. But no, it certainly worked for me. So I feel so much better.
I love that Johnny was the one that kind of was your trigger, because it doesn't matter when it happens or who is the person that instigates it. I think the important thing is in midlife that you address it. For all kinds of reasons, and health reasons, if not aesthetic reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I was within the healthy weight range, so it wasn't, but I knew myself that I wasn't feeling comfortable.
And so do you feel like you've got more energy?
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, just and perhaps maybe a little bit more confidence in myself. And it's interesting talking to some of the people I work with in the studios, like the camera guys and vision mixers, say that I'm less fussed about what I'm wearing and, you know, so I think it's definitely brought kind of, yeah, more confidence and definitely more energy, sleep better, eat better. Yeah, it's all been positive so far.
Yeah, and finding it easy to, once it's a habit, it becomes your lifestyle and you make the plans. Like in our job, I mean, this weekend, for example, I'm working on athletics where I'm going to be on air 9 hours in the day in two chunks. So you have to plan, right, okay, when am I going to eat? What am I going to eat? Because otherwise you can get sucked into that whole very unhealthy eating habits, as we know.
If you looked in the green room at the snooker, when we're maybe doing 12 hours with a couple of breaks, it's just the snacks are off the scale.
We can say the word Haribo here. It's
Haribo, chocolate, you name it, crisps.
It's not good stuff.
So, and then you're finishing late at night, so you're having a glass of wine, and then you say, oh, somebody suggests a late night curry, and before you know it, it's like, oh my God. So that has been a big change, and really thinking about what I'm going to eat when I'm working. And as you say, I don't eat meat as well, so it's not very easy. Lots of people, I see them sitting eating chicken and ham and whatever, you know, good protein, but I don't eat
that. Getting that protein
And getting snacky food that's not full of bread and pasta is quite tricky.
Yeah, and I think in midlife as well, and it's not just women, men as well, it's that feeling that you can kind of just become a little bit invisible if you, and it's interesting you're saying that fussing about your clothes and things, you don't want to have to think about that when you're on telly, do you? You want to be able to do your job the best you can, which you do brilliantly. And in your introduction, I say that you are the master of the track side, ringside, snooker table side interview in terms of that kind of athlete immediately out of their competitive arena, which is one of the hardest places to interview an athlete, I think.
I think so. But I think if you approach it the way I've always approached it, which is when you meet somebody who's just come off the field of play, whether it's a rugby player or a cyclist, whoever they might be, you assume that they have done their very level best. You know, if they have not performed, they are disappointed. Mm. And so you have to respect that. And you have to realise they haven't had time to probably process what's happened. So the winning interviews are actually really easy.
They're easy, yeah.
It's when people have not performed or have a crushing disappointment or maybe just not quite got there. Mm. That's where you need to be really mindful of how they've come to be in that position. And so I always think if you treat everybody with the proper respect, then you will have longevity because they will always, you know, respect you back. Mm. And I think that's been my rule of thumb. Instead of going for that cheap one-off
clickbait
smart comment, that's no use to them or me. So yeah, I think it's a real privilege. You must feel the same, you know, some of the amazing places that you get to go and watch and be involved in sports. So it's a huge privilege. You must therefore respect the privilege.
But also at the same time, being a journalist, you have to ask the questions that are tricky and a little bit more searching that they might not feel like they want to answer in that moment. And that is, of course, by building up respect. And you've certainly done that.
And if I ask a question, I will ask it in the proper manner, not an aggressive, smart way. You've got to ask it in the proper manner.
Were you always able to do that? Because I'm thinking back to the beginning of my career, and I kind of looked, you know, we all subliminally or consciously mimic sometimes, you know, when you're in situations where you're not quite sure how to do something. And at the beginning of my career, I looked and there were a lot of blokes who seemed to be asking very aggressively in those situations, and there weren't as many women around. Clearly, we're similar age, and so I think I for a short time fell into a trap of thinking I had to ask that question in that way, and then I felt like it wasn't me really to talk like that to another human being.
Yeah, I think I always had that approach. I came up through newspapers, and which you have much more time to talk to people when you're doing interviews, but you sort of get used to a sort of rhythm of an interview and the way people talk to you and the way you talk back to them. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm very happy to ask the difficult questions when they come and have done so many times, but I've done it in a way that I hope they understand why I'm asking the question. And a couple of times people have said to me, don't ask me that, or I'm not talking about that. You know, I'm not answering a question about that. I say, well, I have to be seen to ask it. So I'm going to ask the question. Whether you answer it or not is up to you.
And in terms of feeling like you are not the friend of that person, because, you know, we all know that, I mean, I've been there where you feel like you've made a connection with somebody in the sense that you think, oh, this is great. Now, the next time I interview this person, and then the next time you interview them, they lose or they have a disappointing performance and they're not the same friendly guy or girl they were before. Did that come quite quickly to you when you realised that actually, you know?
There's a line, and obviously it is funny because particularly in the rugby environment, like very similar to you, a lot of the guys coming through the ranks, my husband played with and I grew up with, you know, guys like...
So just say for anybody who doesn't know, Jill's husband, Hoggy, was a rugby player. And my husband, Kenny, was a rugby player. And they kind of grew up through the age ranks in Scotland together at the same time. So, yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of those guys, like Gregor Townsend, of course, I've known since we were teenagers. So obviously when you interview him, and if Scotland have not performed, he knows I've got to ask the questions, but I'm going to ask them in a respectful way, as I would to Warren Gatland or whoever else, Gonzalo Casado, whoever it might be. So some are your friends, but some are just people that you get to know. But you must be professional. There's a line. If it's too matey, I mean, nobody likes seeing that. It becomes almost exclusive to the viewer. So I think you just need to do the job professionally. And if you happen to know them really well, like I've had to interview Carl on occasions, I'm sure you've had to interview Kenny, which is hilarious.
We were just talking about the other day, actually. It was at the end of his career. His last game was in the World Cup in Australia against Australia in the quarterfinal.
In Brisbane.
Yeah. And we'd had a big night out after the match because we thought that was, you know, that was it. He was finished. And then I got a call from ITV because I was working for them at the time on the World Cup the following morning, really early. We thought it'd be a great idea for you to do a sit down interview with Kenny because it's the end of his career. And I was not in a state that I was intending to work. All I was intending to do that day was fly back to Sydney, which was our base. So we found ourselves in this makeshift kind of studio setup by a swimming pool. Neither of us could string a word together. Probably somewhere in the archives is the world's worst interview conducted and also, you know, on his side, delivered by Kenny, who normally, as you know, is quite good at talking, but didn't seem to be able to string a sentence together that morning. But that's a weird dynamic. I've interviewed my dad as well when I was at Sky. He was, I think he was managing Huddersfield at the time and had to do a two-way with him, which was also awkward. I think at the end I made a joke about, you know, tell mum I'm home at the weekend, which the producer quite liked. But I thought, because otherwise you're kind of not acknowledging that this is your father that you're interviewing.
I know. I think Kelly said the same with Kenny. Yeah. It's just that kind of slightly awkward. I'm sure Kirsty's had to interview her father
when she's
been covering the golf and the Ryder Cup. So nobody seems to be interested in me interviewing my sheep farming father, but
I don't know. I could see you on Country File. That would be
that'd be my dream job.
Would it be your dream job?
Yeah,
would
I'd
it?
Love that.
Is all this working towards Country File?
Yes. the truth is out. I know Adam as well. Lovely Adam Henson. Yeah. He lives near me, and he's a mate. And I'm like, pick me, Adam.
Because you grew up in farming community and your dad says farmer. The sporting journalism, was it always, because you mentioned newspapers, was it always a career in sport you were looking for?
No, not at all. Nor was it television. I went into journalism very keen to write for The Times. And so I started in a local newspaper. News was my passion. And so I covered crime, politics, local government, you name it, you know.
What was the paper called?
The Southern Reporter. It was a weekly broadsheet and it was a great place to start. And John Smale was my editor. He really taught me the craft. And I studied at Napier to do newspaper journalism. I was a serious news hound. But no, I just by chance fell into television. I was at a press conference asking some punchy questions. Then I went to the courtroom to do a court case. And when I came out, the head of news for Border Television was driving past, recognised me from the press conference, stopped, curb crawled me in a kind of creepy way and said, had I ever thought about television? And I said, no. And he said, come and talk to me. So I went to see him and he said, come and do a week with us and see how you get on. And so I started working as a sub. I was writing the news. And then he said, have you ever thought about presenting? And I said, no. Oh, have a go at that. And then I became a reporter, a presenter. And then I did that for a number of years. And then I always volunteered for the sports stories because I loved
doing sport. Yeah.
And I had some pretty tough times in news, some really difficult stories, a couple of really bad court cases, which I hadn't quite realised the emotional impact they might have. Mm. And around that time, BBC Scotland were looking for a replacement for BBC Rugby Special. And so they said, come and screen test for that. And I said, you're never going to let a girl present Rugby Special. Nobody's going to see it.
What year would this be?
That was in 1997. I was so young.
Right.
So young. And so I got the job presenting Rugby Special, which caused a real stir at the time.
I would have been at Sky for a year at that point.
It caused a big stir. And I can remember I was in the Times, I was in the Scotsman, I was in all the papers about this, you know, what would people think of this girl presenting rugby? And that's kind of where it started. And so I fell into television, I fell into sport, then found I loved it and never looked back.
When I met Kenny in 99 and they won the Five Nations and we went up for the big celebration, I was in the bar the next day with like lots of the wives and girlfriends, and they all, at the time I'd just gone to ITV, and they were going, do you know Jill Douglas? You must know Jill Douglas, because they obviously all knew you. And I said, well, I've not really come across Jill Douglas. Little did I know how big a part of my life Jill Douglas would play as the years went by. So you were obviously at that point really forging a name for yourself in rugby particularly. But then so many other sports have gone, you know, as is the nature of our business. I think when you're good at one thing and you're really good at live television, there's a bit of snooker here we would like to, or there's a bit of, just try this, try that. Which was the next sport? Was it cycling?
Cycling. So I did a bit of athletics at Sky and quite a bit of football because I was presenting sports news. But then when I went back to Network BBC, I had a phone call. I can remember it vividly. It was a Friday. I was up in the Scottish Borders and this producer called John Graham called me up. It was 2003 and he said, would I go to Stuttgart to present these track cycling world championships? And I didn't even give it a beat. I said, yes. When is it? And it was coming up pretty soon. And nobody else was keen to do it because we were all right at track cycling. You know, Jason Quealy had won the gold medal in Sydney. The sprinters had won a medal the year before at the World Championships. But
did you know that they were on the precipice of greatness?
I knew Chris Hoy. And so I went to Stuttgart and honestly, it was the most thrilling, exciting thing ever. And that year, Bradley Wiggins won his first senior world title. He was the individual pursuit title in 2003 in Stuttgart. And then sort of fast forward 20 years and here I am still following people going
and you've
very
been
fast
through
in circles.
The absolute golden years of cycling as well. I filled in for you once. You must have been having a baby and it was Warsaw.
It was 2009 and it was Pruskov. Yeah, it was the
Were you having Rosie?
I was too heavy
to travel. And you know, because I thought it would be very exciting, and I ended up having to, what happened to me?
I had to come home.
I was really ill. I ended up having to spend half the trip in a doctor's with some terrible flu-like thing. But the days that I did spend in the arena was very exciting. Lots going on, but mostly to the background noise of. Where's Jill? Why is Jill not here? I was like, all right, guys. I felt like wearing a T-shirt saying, don't worry, I'm temporary. Jill's coming back very soon.
It was funny because you sadly were unwell and had to go home.
And then so John Inverdale.
Simon Brotherton filled in for a bit and then John Inverdale. And so I said to them, God, it takes three of them to do what I do all the time. Three of them. Come on.
It does remind me a lot, though, of obviously doing athletics, as I have done for about 11, 12 years now. It's very similar in the sense that you have a lot of different disciplines, a lot of great personalities, and also sports people who really do want to talk to you because they know that their moment in the sun is you know, is fleeting, and they don't get that television coverage that footballers do, who are much more reluctant to come and do an interview. And these days, even increasingly so rugby players, because, you know, kind of back in the day when rugby was truly amateur and then there was the hybrid period, they seemed a little bit more kind of forthcoming. But, you know, they get more media trained, don't they? Have you found that in terms of the rugby particularly, the media training that athletes and sports people have?
Yeah, a little bit. Some of it's good because they understand the nature of live television and they understand they're taught the opportunity that's being presented to them. So it's a chance to connect with people, often a chance to thank people who've been influential in their careers. So I think...
And not to swear.
And not to swear.
I don't know how Kenny ever went on telly as a 19-year-old and didn't swear.
Because I was saying, don't swear, Kenny. But no, I think you still get the real characters. And usually when I'm talking to people, it's maybe in the pre-race time... they're a bit more polished, but I think now, you know, when they're in that raw emotion, you still get the real personality coming through. You think about somebody like Laura Kenny. You know, Laura is so candid and amazing and brilliant. And some of my happiest, most brilliant interviews have been with Laura. You know, when she won in London, throwing up, she was like throwing up, you know, just because she put herself through, and she just, I can't believe it. She's so genuine.
And when she's talking now even about her, you know, pregnancies and coming back, and I was listening to her the other day just feeling she's so emotionally connected and delivers it so brilliantly, and it stands out because of that, doesn't she? That you invest in her journey then, you know, you really want her to do it and to get there, and obviously this summer you'll be there again, won't you, with the cyclists?
Yes, Saint-Quentin, the velodrome down there, which is near Versailles, which is beautiful, and I did a World Championships there in 2015, maybe? I can't remember. Yeah, I think it was 2015 they had the World Championships in France, and at the velodrome. It was brand new then. It had a leaky roof. I remember them mopping the velodrome, mopping the track at one point.
How'd they improve that?
I think they've fixed it now. But it's a great place to be. And the Olympics, you know, it's the pinnacle of the track cycling career. So we'll have road cycling as well, which will be amazing. But I think... yeah, it'll be good fun, the track.
I think the venues, I mean, I've been kind of drooling over them for about a year now. I'm going on the websites and looking, and the venues look superb. And, you know, God willing, it'll be a safe, brilliant, fantastic Olympics that will reignite people's passion and love. Because I think it's difficult when, as we've had in the last few iterations, that you have the time zone difference where you don't get those big events for us. I mean, this is being purely selfish and kind of British-centric, but when they're out of time zones, it's difficult, isn't it? And actually, this will feel a bit more like a home games. I've heard so many more people saying they're going. You
know? And even if they haven't got tickets, because the tickets are fiendishly expensive.
Oh, tell me. I went on to try and find some for Lois the other day. I mean, they're gone. The show jumping, I think it must have gone on day one, but they were hundreds and hundreds of pounds.
It's ridiculous.
Euros.
It's pricing it out of people's market. But anyway, people will come just to be part of the Olympic experience, I think. Mm. And I was in Japan 4 years ago, 3 years ago, whenever it was.
One of the few.
And it was not a joyful experience. Mm. It was great to be there. And
it's so sad for the athletes, but not having family.
If that was your one hit, you know. And so it'll be much, much better this time around. Having been in Japan for the World Cup and the way that the Japanese people embraced it and the fun that we all had.
They didn't get to have that moment.
Yeah, it's a real shame. So I think the way that the French supported the Rugby World Cup was absolutely off the scale, and they put on such a show. So I'm really excited about the Olympics.
Well, I think French rugby has been getting a lot right, hasn't it, over the last few years in terms of club rugby and the atmosphere, and going to a game is so different. You and I both know, obviously, about, you know, the club rugby in this country is in trouble in various places, and three clubs went, and more clubs are, you know, kind of on the line. And you look across the water and think that experience draws people in, doesn't it? And, you know, it's not just about the 80 minutes on the pitch. It's everything that goes around it as well. It's much more like American sport.
Yeah, they just make the whole match day experience special, I think. Mm. I think the Olympics will take a leaf out of that and really make it an exceptional experience. And I think even if you haven't got tickets, there are things like the road race you can go along and watch, you know. You can just be there. The time trial, you can be there on the side of the road and feel part of it.
And you often find you can pick up tickets as well. Things happen. So it's well worth getting on a train, getting over, I think, to Paris if you've got any interest in Olympic sport. Can you believe, when you look back at the start of your career, and I always quote the boss I had at Sky, who pretty much told me I'd be finished by the time I was 30. I can't believe that I'm about to go to my,
was that Vic?
Yeah. You won't be on my screen when you're 28.
Could I tell you a Vic story?
Yeah.
I said to Vic, I'd like to leave. I think it's maybe not working for me. I think, you know, I don't feel I really want to be, I want to be at live events. Mm. And he said, people say I only employ fit young things that look great on telly and know nothing about sport. And I say, no, look at Jill Douglas.
No.
I'm not sure about this, actually.
That is obviously a compliment, because he's saying you're incredibly knowledgeable. I think he was meaning as well as being a fit young thing. So when you look back at that time, you look forwards to what you've done and how many Olympic Games you've been to, World Championships, and here we are in midlife still doing what we do. It feels like progress has been made.
I think so. And, you know, I've got no intention to slow down. I feel like I want to do more. You know, I'm really loving it. And I think, you know, you build up such experience and contacts and, you know, knowledge. Why would you not want to carry on doing that? And I think, you know, even in business, I look at businesses who they have a real drain of talent leaving in their 50s and 60s. Mm. People who are really vested in that business, often because the women are not managing their menopause properly or have not been given an opportunity to manage that properly within that work environment. And they're lost and they're having to retrain and bring in people. Now, of course, you want people to progress and bring people up through the ranks. But at the same time, if you've invested all that time in developing somebody, you know, why would you want to lose them when they're actually in their prime and they're exactly what the kind of people that you want to be taking senior management executive positions? And that's why so many of these positions are held by men, because the women have either had time off for family and have not been able to come back at the right level, or have left the business. Mm. So from my point of view, I feel as though I'm, you know, I've got so much enthusiasm and energy.
You've done all the thousands of hours.
I've put the hours in. I've done my, you know, air miles. Now it's time to really reap the rewards and benefit, and hopefully, you know, get to enjoy some incredible experiences, because, you know, we are lucky to go and do what we do.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
We'll be right back.
And at the same time, you've just stood down as CEO of the My Name's Dodie Foundation, which you were involved with for 6 years. Tell me on your decision-making on that then and how you came to decide it was the right time.
It's a huge responsibility. I think we went from, none of us imagined what it would become, but at the same time, we were very ambitious. And so when we began the foundation, we wanted to make a difference. We wanted to use Dodie's voice and energy and profile to turn the dial on MND and MND research. And so I think we've done that. We continue to do that. We have raised millions of pounds and have invested.
Are you allowed to say how much
we've raised? Well, we've committed £11 million into research so far and £2 million into helping people with the disease. And we've still got money in the bank ready to go in our next round of grants. And we've got a really exciting new grant programme coming out probably in the next 10 days, which we will be sharing. And that's a really significant amount of money. And it will change the landscape in some regards. So, you know, I've recruited really well. I've built a team of brilliant people. We've built a team of brilliant people. I've worked with Kenny since the beginning. Sean McGrath, another person who has been really instrumental in driving us forward. We've got to a position now where we raise significant funds and have got incredible, incredible, incredible supporters doing amazing things for us.
It is amazing how the brand, the tartan, the awareness is so ubiquitous, you know?
Yeah, and that comes with a huge amount of enthusiasm and excitement and energy has gone into it. And now where we are, when we lost Dodie, I always knew there'd be a timeline for me because I did it because he wanted me to do it. Mm. But I've got a lot of other things I want to do. Mm. And so for the last year, I've really been giving it a lot of thought. And it needs somebody that's not doing all the other things that I enjoy doing. It needs somebody who's 100% focus is the foundation, because we've now built a team of people. We're responsible for that core team of people who work for the foundation. But also, it's a huge amount of money to be responsible for investing in the proper way. So we've got people on board to do that. We've got an incredible research review panel who look at all of our different investments. And so it's a lot of responsibility. Mm. And I felt the time was right, having got to where we are now and have this brilliant team in place, to say, great, you run with this now. I will step back from the day-to-day running of the business and now be involved in, you know, helping where I can, using
attending events and doing using your voice and your platform.
Exactly.
And you know more than anybody really what is going on in the charity, in the space, and you can talk so brilliantly about it anywhere. I've heard you speak at many dinners and many functions. When Dodie was diagnosed and, you know, that this all started, obviously all of his close friends and anybody who really knew him, I think, felt that this was the cruelest thing for somebody who had so much life and so much passion and, you know, was really out there. And it galvanized people so quickly. It was incredible how it took off so quickly. You've known Dodie pretty much your whole life. You met as teenagers. So obviously your involvement, I imagine, in the charity in some way helped prepare you, did it, for the inevitable, that you could feel you'd done everything you possibly could to help him.
Yeah, listen, nothing prepares you to lose somebody that you love. Nothing prepares you for the sort of grief and loss and the compassion and heartache you feel for those that are closest to them. So Kathy and the boys, you know, they were kind of our priority. And I suppose, you know, I think one of the things the foundation did was give me time with Dodie in the last few years, real quality time. Because we had a lot to talk about and he was so committed to what we were doing. And so that was special. And to see the enjoyment and that he took from the way we were moving forward. But he was also desperately impatient and frustrated at times. And, you know, I think we take a lot of that still into how we operate. We're very disruptive and challenging, and we want to make a difference. We want to shout and stamp our foot occasionally. And that was very much how he was. But also, he had so much humour and fun and joy in his life. You know, if you could bottle that and give it to people, it would make us all happier people. And so I think of that when I think of Dodie. I don't think about Dodie with MND. I don't think about... That didn't define who he was. No. I think of him and the fun we had, you know, and the kind of larger-than-life character and... yeah, just the joy that he brought to people and the fun and just being on the farm. You know, you've been up there and it was just like a special place to be in his company with Kathy and the boys, just talking nonsense, really. So, yeah, it's been a difficult year for everybody close to him, but I think he'd be really proud of where the foundation is and how it's moving forward. And, it now is a proper, sustainable, respected charity heading in the right direction. And long may that last. Listen, if we could find a cure, there'd be no need for us anymore. Mm. But we're away off that. But we're doing all we can. And that's all we can do.
Well, we're going to bring in somebody in just a moment who will tell us how far away that might be. But before we do, I wonder how much his passing at the age that he was, the time of life and, you know, being in midlife, did it kind of focus your mind in any way in terms of, okay, this is how I want to live the rest of my life. This is what I want to do with my life.
I think his diagnosis made us all take a breath and think about our priorities.
The mortality. Really.
Yeah. And like I lost my brother-in-law when he was 47, my sister's husband, which was desperate, you know, absolutely desperate. He had three young boys who are incredible young men. But it was tough. And I think when Doddy was diagnosed and losing him, you know, in his early 50s, it does make you think you want to embrace life. You want to do all you can for your kids and spend time with them. So I think getting your work-life balance right, looking after yourself, you know, making yourself healthy. You know, feeling healthy is so important. And not worrying, don't sweat the small stuff, you know. My sister's mantra, don't sweat the small stuff. And it is, I live by that because I think, you know what, we don't know what's around the corner. And Doddy always said that. He said, live your life with fun and joy in your heart because you do not know what's around the corner. And so you can't just joué. You've got to be responsible. But at the same time, you know, to live your life and embrace it. And as you say, prioritise.
Be in the moment. Well, let's bring in Amal Al-Shalabi, who's Professor of Neurology and Complex Disease Genetics. Thank you so much for spending a bit of time with us today, Amal, who will hopefully be able to give us a bit of an indication of where all this money that Jill and the team at My Name's Doddy have been raising is going to go. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me on.
So, first things first, this is not an easy question to answer, I appreciate, but a lot of people will know that MND is a degenerative disease that, you know, can sometimes be a year or two somebody would have it before they die, and other people live with it for years and sometimes decades. And there seems to be many variations. It's very hard to generalize. Is there an average age when you get diagnosis, or is this a disease that can affect anybody?
Both are true. So it's a disease that can affect anybody at any age. The youngest person I've ever seen was about 15, and the oldest person was about 102. But the peak age is 56. So it's the commonest neurodegenerative disease of midlife. So most people we see in clinic are in their 50s to 60s.
And we don't know yet what triggers it at a certain time. I understand that there's no one thing that you can say, well, this is why it was that time in that person's life.
We can't say why it happens at that time, but we're getting some insight into what controls that. So one of the things we know is that there are six steps that have to happen in the cells in the body to trigger motor neuron disease. And we know that up to four of those steps can be genetic factors. They don't have to be, but they can be in some people. And we don't know what the other steps are, but they're probably either just chance or aging or things that people are exposed to in their lives. So it's a mix of both genetics and environment.
And in terms of the motor neuron disease diagnosis that Doddy had, how common was his? How, you know, is there a most common diagnosis? Is there a strain that is more prevalent?
So there's a difference between what the public understands about motor neuron disease, which is these different types. So, so you'll hear types, if you're ever affected with motor neuron disease and you Google it, you'll come across terms like PLS or PMA or bulbar palsy. There's different classifications and names, but really they're all the same thing, which is what we call ALS. So in most of the world, motor neuron disease is known as ALS.
So what Doddy was inspired by the most, I remember at the very beginning, the conversations he used to have was that his absolute rage almost, that nothing had seemed to have been kind of developed or progressed over the decades before his diagnosis. He couldn't believe that there wasn't something new. There wasn't a panacea. There wasn't a magic pill that was being worked on. And that was what he wanted, the energy to kind of keep going and try and get some kind of cure or something that slows down the rate of the disease's degeneration. How close are you and how much progress has been made since the start of Doddy's journey?
So it's always difficult because of the historical perspective. So I've been researching this since, about 30 years almost to the day, actually. And in that time, a huge amount has happened. But if you're newly diagnosed, it can appear that nothing has happened because there isn't a cure, as you've said. But just, for example, in the last week, we've had an announcement from the European Medicines Agency that a drug has been licensed for motor neurone disease that essentially, not in everybody, but it can stop the disease in the 2% of people that have a particular genetic cause of their motor neurone disease. So that still leaves 98% of people we've got to find a proper treatment for. But that's a massive breakthrough, even though it's just for 2% of people. Mm.
So if you're in that 2%, sorry to interrupt, if you're in that 2%, wherever you start taking the drugs, it will plateau, your symptoms will plateau rather than reverse.
At the moment, it's really a very new discovery, so we don't know all the detail about it. It looks like the sooner you take it, the more likely it is to stop the condition. And some people have very aggressive motor neurone disease and you really can't get to it quite fast enough. And so you can't stop it in those people, even though it might slow it down. But if you can get it early enough, it looks like it will significantly stop it and plateau. And there is, although it's early days yet, there is some indication that the body then tries to heal itself and there may be some recovery.
So for the 98% who don't have that strain, where is the research heading at the moment and what areas are you making progress and seeing light?
So to make a cure, you have to understand what's causing the condition. And we're making a lot of progress in that, not fast enough, but that's because it's actually an incredibly complex, difficult thing to study. In cancer, you can take a bit of the cancer, study it in a dish, and then you understand what's going on. In a neurodegenerative disease, you can't take a bit of somebody's nervous system because that will paralyze them or make their disease worse. And so we're stuck with indirect ways of trying to understand what's going on. But we are making good progress with that. So, for example, we now know that inflammation seems to be an important factor that will determine how fast motor neurone disease progresses. We know that from some of the genetic findings, we know that some proteins in the cells don't behave in the way they should, and there are methods that we might be able to use to correct that. So we're now doing clinical trials that are addressing all of those different methods. I think one of the things that this tofersen drug, this SOD1, the 2% drug that seems to work in those people, one of the things that's achieved, apart from obviously the incredible breakthrough for them, is that it's meant that we can see that motor neurone disease, it is possible to stop it. It's not an impossible disease to treat. Mm. It's a crackable condition. And the pharmaceutical industry has seen that. And because of that, we now have more trials than ever. When I first started, we used to have, on average, less than one trial a year to offer our patients. So most people couldn't get into a trial. Now we've got 6 or 7 on the go at any one time. And that's because people now realize that it's a treatable condition.
And so many people kind of are quite confused by the definition of rare disease, aren't they? Because it seems like you hear lots of people who have the diagnosis. First of all, what's classed as a rare disease and just how rare is it? How many people receive a diagnosis in the UK every year?
Yeah, so motor neurone disease is both rare and not rare. It depends on how you think of
it. It's a bloody complex bugger, isn't it? Sorry for the swearing. But I mean, it seems to contradict itself quite a lot, doesn't it?
So it's rare because not many people will have it at any one time. And that's the reason that happens is because people die with it.
It really
significantly shortens your life. Mm. So the average survival, 50% of people are dead within 2 years of their first symptoms. So it's terrible from that point of view. If we could stop motor neurone disease in all the people who developed it, then it would be as common as multiple sclerosis in the UK. So 1 in 300 people will die of motor neurone disease. So if you think that's rare, I don't think that's particularly rare, 1 in 300 people. But if you say, how many people does that mean per year? Well, it's roughly 1 to 2 in every 100,000 people. So about 10 to 20 in a million people. So it's not a huge number per year. In terms of your individual risk, it's 1 in 300. That's quite high.
And obviously, the foundation and also other high-profile fundraising activities that have gone on with Rob Burrow and Kevin Sinfield, of course, as well, have raised the profile of motor neurone disease in the last few years. And it certainly gets talked about more. People are much more aware of the horrific hand that people are dealt when they receive that diagnosis. How has that helped the community that is trying to make that headway and come up with a cure?
Absolutely, hugely. The My Name's Dolly Foundation has been pivotal in that, along with MND Scotland and the MND Association, Rob Burrows. It's helped because by raising awareness, it's meant we can not only fundraise, as the fundraisers do, but we've been able to lobby government successfully to launch an MND research institute nationally. And that's helped bring all of the different researchers together. It's helped to focus and coordinate all of that research so that we're all pulling in the same direction at the same time, instead of people working in their little silos and not necessarily sharing. Mm.
And is that a global picture? Or do you tend to work within the UK in terms of research?
No, we definitely work very internationally. So in fact, that meeting I was telling you about where the announcement was made, that was in Europe. That was a European group that we work with, and we work internationally. So I had an international meeting this morning with some of our collaborators in the US. I came back from the US about a month ago, and I'm likely to go to Australia to speak. We go to Malaysia. We link in with everybody internationally.
Amma, obviously, Doddy was a very famous rugby international, and Rob Burrows, rugby league, and then Stephen Darby from football, and Ed Slater as well, who, of course, the Gloucester player who has been living with MND for the last couple of years. So there are more cases as well, more sports people that we could mention. So a lot of people are inevitably asking the question, is this related? Is their diagnosis related to the sport that they played? Is there anything to do with the high-level sports performance that could link a diagnosis of motor neurone disease?
Well, it's something that we've always suspected as neurologists. But when we see people with motor neurone disease come to the clinic, very often they are, in the days of paper notes, they used to have very, very thin notes. When we speak to people, they've often not had any illness before in their life. And they often say, oh, I was down the gym doing my usual weights, or I was running my second marathon that week. They're often doing a lot of sport, and then they notice the symptoms. That doesn't mean that sport causes motor neurone disease, because it might be that if you have a nervous system that makes you very good at sport, and so you tend to do it, maybe that same nervous system predisposes you to motor neurone disease. So it doesn't mean there's a link between the two in the sense of causation, but it's an interesting thing that we noticed. And so people have tried to study that with questionnaires and things like that. It's very difficult to find a real link doing that. A very good study has been done by a group in Liverpool, led by Dame Professor Pam Shaw, which is funded partly by the My Name's Dolly Foundation. The most recent bit is funded by them. That study looked at people with a particular genetic background and asked if there was a relationship with sport. And it's showing that there might be, in certain situations, people with a particular genetic makeup might be more likely to develop motor neurone disease, but it's only going to be a small increase in risk, and definitely the benefits of sport would massively outweigh the risk of getting
it. I was going to say, so does that mean that if they hadn't done sport, the genetic link would still have been there but not triggered?
So that's what the Sheffield team is trying to discover.
Right.
Because it might just be that you'll get it anyway. Genetic link.
Yeah. Right.
The one thing people often ask, Amma, is about head injury, and there is no link with head injury. No link. Certainly nothing has come out of any research to suggest there's any link. In fact, Nordic skiers were more likely to develop MND for some reason. So, you know, I always say to people, if people say, must be a link with concussion or head trauma, no, that has never been shown. More research is needed, in my view, but certainly there is never
no link.
Because my husband had more head knocks and more concussion than Doddy, so there we go.
Mm. How likely do you think it is then that in the next 10 years, 15 years, we may one day turn the news on and hear those amazing words that we all, if we're invested in this area, want to hear, that there is a cure for motor neurone disease?
I would, if you'd asked me that when I first started, I'd have said never. But I do think it's not impossible now. By understanding it more and by having these faster, larger numbers of trials, by working in this more coordinated way, it's definitely a possibility. And we know from this treatment for the genetic 2%, we know that it is a crackable condition. So I think, I really hope that we do make that breakthrough. More likely, we'll make a significant impact on slowing the disease. And by doing that repeatedly, we'll actually eventually stop its progression and hopefully reverse it.
You know more about this area, Jill, than you probably ever imagined you would, and sat on so many of these meetings and in the meetings that decide where the research, where the money goes. It's so important for you and the foundation that every pound that's raised, you know, is significant in terms of where it's going.
Absolutely. And people like Amar have been incredibly patient. It's been a steep learning curve, but, you know, Amar has been such a brilliant friend to the foundation. He and the research community in the UK are at the forefront in the world. I mean, we have got some incredible, incredible people, clinicians and researchers in this country who are really working so hard to make a difference. And so we are so appreciative of the fact that we get time to spend with Amar and Chris and all the other guys who we regularly meet, have a scientific advisory meeting, which we started, where we bring together sort of leading researchers and discuss progress and what we can do, what's happening in their world. But I think one of the great things about those meetings, Amar, you would agree, is not only do we have a formal agenda and we talk about the different work streams that are happening, but we have that social time together. And I love seeing, you know, you and Kevin or Pam sitting in a corner having these really exciting conversations. And as a result, progress is made. And I think that's been a real important part of, like, I feel that, yes, the fundraising is important, but for me, that's one of our big contributions.
I agree. Actually, a lot of the research collaborations and the research ideas come out of those informal things where you just network and just meet somebody and you spark off each other with the new ideas.
And you do brilliant things, will continue to do brilliant things. And I think with the foundations that have been laid, the fact that, you know, my name's Doddy is around the world, you know, and people recognise the tartan, they recognise what that stands for, and they recognise the great man himself wanted one day for there to be a legacy. He knew that he was not going to have time to see that. But how many families and people will be hopefully one day, you know, the beneficiaries of that is what I think keeps us all inspired, isn't it?
Absolutely. And you know, we try to work with everybody who's got the similar goal. So, you know, you mentioned MND Scotland, MND Association. We try, you know, we're collaborative. I think that's the whole point. You know, as a community, we're very strong when we come together. We all have different priorities and we all work in our own way. But yeah, we're hopeful. We've got to be, you know, that's what Doddy was. And I think, you know, we've got to follow that path.
Amar, thank you so much for your time and for kind of distilling things down in a way that is easier for people like me who haven't got the background in neuroscience to understand and keep doing what you do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gabby.
Yeah, I think that was one of the truly kind of brave things about Doddy's initial kind of manifesto almost, that he knew quite quickly, didn't he, that he wouldn't see this come into fruition for himself, but it was other families.
I think at the beginning... Well, I think he probably thought, at the very beginning, right, we're going to do something about this. And he hoped that something would come for him. I think there was a realization as time went on that that wasn't going to be the case, which shifted the focus then to, okay, let's accelerate whatever is likely to bring about an effective treatment. And so that was the sort of mind shift. But yeah, he was the most positive individual, and I think that positivity rubbed off on everybody around him, and it still is something I'm very acutely aware of. That, you know, even in the darkest of times, there would be a twinkle in the eye and that sort of sense of fun and mischief, but also real positivity. And he shared that so generously with families and other people who were given this diagnosis very quietly. You know, not publicly. Spent time with people. Would often just pick up the phone and talk to people. You know. I can't overstate just the impact he had on people's lives. You know, people who were going through the darkest of times, he was very, very generous with his time.
And also, I think, was able, because of his personality and the community, the rugby community, sports communities can be incredibly giving when it comes to getting together and galvanising, you know, their energies to put towards a cause. But he particularly was able to do that. I mean, that must have made your jobs at the foundation quite easy in terms of picking up the phone. You know, it's for Doddy and people. Yeah. Okay.
It's funny. Like, people loved Doddy, you know? They didn't just like him. They didn't just know him off the rugby field or he used to turn up. People genuinely loved him. They had a real connection with him. And because he had spent a lot of time after he retired yes, on the farm, but also he had his business, which was the sort of drainage and sewage business. And then he used all of that kind of experience and humour when he did the sort of after-dinner circuit. So he went the length and breadth of the country and internationally, speaking at dinners and events, and he made these incredible connections. So I get people now, you know, who get in touch and say, oh, I met Doddy at a rugby dinner or a fundraising lunch or whatever it might be 15 years ago in Timbuktu, and we want to do something for Doddy. And I love that. And they've all got a story, and usually there's an accompanying photograph, and it's usually some very small person and Doddy picking them up or like, you know, standing them on a chair or, you know, downing a pint or something ridiculous. So I think just people loved him, and he had a wicked sense of humour. Mm. And yeah, so I think his personality made it easier for us to ask people to do things. And he, of course, was very good at asking people to do things.
Yeah, yeah. He was very persuasive, and had right to the end, really, such a twinkle in his eye, didn't he? He loved a bit of mischief. We were fortunate enough to have popped in to see him 3 weeks before. And he sat in the kitchen and he was making jokes and, you know, kind of
teasing the kids
and Kathy, and you know, and that spirit, I think, is what you've harnessed so brilliantly. So that whole experience that you've been through over the last 6 to 8 years has clearly been life changing in many ways for you, Jill.
It has, because I've learned so much. I've made some incredible connections. You know, to be able to go to the launch of the UK M&D Research Institute and see that come to fruition. You know, we took our cause to Downing Street. I've worked with some brilliant, brilliant people.
You got your MBE.
I've got my MBE, which is very lovely. And then, you know, I took myself off to LSE to do a course in managerial finance, because I thought if I'm going to be running this multi-million pounds charity, I need to really be able to dive into our accounts and understand them and question and challenge everybody that works with us. So it's been a real steep learning curve, but so, so rewarding. Mm-hmm. And I think all of my experience in broadcasting and news and brand, because I do some work with Gallagher Insurance, and I came through a sort of marketing experience through my work within different insurance brokers in the Lloyd's market. So all of that experience has helped me in my role with the foundation. But the foundation has helped me immeasurably just through the experience and the richness of what I've been able to enjoy in the last few years, and some of the incredible people I've met. So I want to carry on supporting the foundation, but I want to use all of that other experience and do something different, channel my energy somewhere else. Because, you know, we talked about midlife and where we are. I'm at that stage where the kids are kind of doing GCSEs and A-levels, and I'm beginning to think about them going off to university. And oh my goodness me, I want to be busy, and I'm never happier than when I'm busy. And
well, you're doing it the right way, because it'll come around really quickly, and you don't want to suddenly wake up one morning and go, God, the house is empty and I haven't thought about this. And I think that is the thing, is to be prepared, isn't it, for that moment.
Oh God, the house will never be empty. Hoggy will be still there.
He is your husband. I don't think he's going off anywhere.
He's not going anywhere. He's not going off to university again. No, but you're right. I think it does come around really quickly. And I remember when the kids were tiny, people saying, enjoy it because they grow up so quickly. Mm. And I thought, what a nonsense. I'm not getting any sleep. I'm exhausted.
I'm walking through treacle every day.
But suddenly blink, and there they are learning to drive, and just brilliant young people, you know, growing into these amazing, amazing people. And so
it's so ironic, isn't it? It's the time you really want to start hanging out with them is when they're going. You're like, no, but I want to hang out with you because you're really funny and I really like your company.
We were skiing last week and they loved it. Great fun, except they kept saying, yeah, you're a half-decent skier, Mum, but you're just so slow.
Oh,
why
don't
are you
tell
so
me.
Slow? Yeah. But then get me into the après-ski. Yeah, I'm not so slow now.
I'll take you on with those vodka shots.
I'll be up on that table before you are. Oh, Mum, you're so embarrassing.
But Mum never believed me when I said, I quite like skiing slowly. I'm really happy. You can go wherever you like, but I'm going to stay here. But that is not going to happen anytime soon, because thankfully Ruben can't ski anymore because of rugby.
No.
So that's good, because we haven't got to spend our whole lives going, no, no, watch out, he's coming. Jill, it's been a joy having this time with you, and very inspirational as always. But
oh,
to hear
to
how
you.
Things are going and how your future looks, which looks really fun, actually. And,
I hope so.
You know, you've done, as you said, you've done all those thousands of hours of live broadcasting. So bring it on, more fun.
Yeah, more fun. And see you in the Olympics.
It's always so lovely to spend time with Jill. We've orbited similar worlds for many years now, but it was wonderful to hear her speak about her career and her favourite moments. And it's great to still be in the game together, and long may it continue. For more episodes with broadcasting greats, you might like to scroll back through the Midpoint archives and listen to Claire Balding, Alex Jones, Gary Lineker and Ben Shepherd's episodes, just to name a few. A warm thanks also to Professor Ammar Al-Shalabi for sharing his knowledge on MND with us. And I think it's only right to sign off with Doddy's wise words. Live your life with fun and joy in your heart, because you never know what's around the corner. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.